Ready to rock.
Cool.
Bring it.
The cost of developing a new drug is far too expensive because too many things fail in phase two and phase three, the most expensive phase of the drug discovery process. They fail because of lack of efficacy, and you start to work backwards and you realize we just picked the wrong targets at the very beginning of the drug discovery process because we don't understand enough about causal human biology.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
For years, medical research seemed focused on understanding disease processes primarily through model organisms such as yeast, flies, and mice. Today's guest, Robert Plenge, offers the radical suggestion that, with the help of emerging technology, quote, humans serve as the best model organism for understanding human health and disease.
This is Tectonics. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz. This episode is sponsored by DNA Nexus, a secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. All right, Lisa, here's a question for you.
All right.
You ready?
Ready.
So a common thread on social media is that more company execs should participate on Twitter. You know, the old, every CEO should be on Twitter. I have a view, but I want to start with yours.
Well, you know, I think it kind of depends on who it is. You got to have a good communication sense, I think, because otherwise you end up with stuff like, I love Hispanics on Taco Tuesday, you know, from Donald Trump. And, you know, there's nothing worse than making yourself look like an ass on social media. So,
see, I worry about, I worry, of course, culturally, but whatever, generations can't be wrong. But about a different thing, what less the sort of the Donald Trump, Trumpisms, and more about actually the tediousness, the sort of the hyper edited faux authentic quote.
Well, yeah.
Where I mean,
if you got the corporate PR machine
yeah.
sending your Twitter feed out, it's not going to be that great.
And then that's the worry is that a lot of these executives, they sort of have to have everything. They have this whole corporate process that you have to pass each tweet through, which seems to sort of defeat the whole purpose of the medium.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think communication skills and a sense of brazen savvy are probably essential to being good at Twitter.
All right. Well, I would say that our guest today, Robert Plenge, VP of Translational Research at Merck Research Labs, is an example of a pharma leader who seems to have pulled this off successfully, authoring a widely respected personal blog about drug discovery called PlengeGen, look it up, and maintaining a thoughtful Twitter presence as well. Welcome, Robert, and tell us how you managed to get away with this.
Thank you very much, and I'm very, very happy and very flattered that you asked for me to participate. So maybe I'll tell you just very quickly about why I use different social media outlets like Twitter and my blog.
Please.
And then the path that it took me to and Merck itself to allow me to do some of the things that I actually do. So I initially started just using Twitter, for example, just for basic news aggregation. And I actually started my webpage and my blog before I left academics. So I was just using it for the traditional reasons that I think many people use web pages, which is to recruit postdocs and graduate students, et cetera.
Right.
And then when I joined Merck, I didn't initially have that external presence, but I actually started to blog internally.
Huh, I didn't know that.
And so I started to write about genetics and drug discovery and many of the themes that I think that we'll actually get to today. And I think that over the course of about a year, they got comfortable with my ability to communicate both internally within Merck, how I would communicate in different forums within Merck, both speaking and writing. And so they allowed me to have this external presence, and they watch, but they watch, you know, with an extremely light touch.
And do you have to have pictures of your executive staff with farm animals in order to continue this?
No. So they've actually, I think with one exception, I think they've never actually said anything about the tweets that I do or the blogs that I write.
What was that exception? Can you share?
Yeah, well, I think that the basic rules are to, of course, not say anything proprietary, to always have the obligatory disclaimer, you know, these are my own thoughts and these are my own tweets and these are my own blog comments. But then I'm very careful about mentioning specific drugs, whether there are drugs or other drugs. And I think it makes sense because whether I say something positive or negative, it could be viewed as trying to influence potentially, I guess, people who would take the medications or people who would prescribe them. So I'm very careful about saying things about drugs.
It's hard to get those drug disclaimers into 140 characters anyway.
Yeah. The primary disclaimers occur on the blogs, not necessarily on the tweets, because as you say, that would take up all the room.
But, you know, this strikes me as such a change in perspective. I mean, really earth-shattering because, you know, I spent a couple of years at Merck, but in pharma companies in general, Merck isn't specific, that generally, for any external communication, there's layers and layers and someone will prepare for any media interview. These are the three talking points. These are the sub-points and everything is sort of so... non-authentic, and if I would say non-authentic, but very prepared and non-spontaneous. And yet what you're writing, it is authentic, and it is, this is what you're thinking about, this is what you're passionate about, and you're so effective at it. I'm just surprised that more, you know, I guess another example of someone who's effective at it would be someone like Vertex, right?
Yes.
Derek Lowe?
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
And he's obviously done a wonderful job, but the fact that you can come up with one or two specific people who are really the exceptions rather than the rules in pharma, what do you think the culture is changing? Do you think it needs to change more? What are your thoughts on this?
There probably are several components of it. So one, I think that I'm senior enough where I can have a voice that people may be interested in listening to, but I'm not so senior in the organization that I actually
affect the stock price.
There's a potential to actually influence the street, for example. So I think I have a kind of a nice level in the organization that allows me to do that.
Oh, that's interesting.
So as long as you don't continue to move up the corporate ladder, you're fine.
Yeah, so this is great. So I turn down promotions all the time so I can continue to do my social media, have my social media presence. But I also do think that we all recognize that the world is smaller in terms of the various groups that interact, academics and industry, and I think this is a topic that we'll get to later as well. But I also think Merck feels like they benefit from having this external presence. I mean, we being Merck, but also the pharmaceutical industry in general, I mean, we need to interact with the external world. I mean, the vast majority, 99.9, whatever the number, the vast majority of ideas are going to come from outside of any institution, whether it's Merck, whether it's Harvard, whether it's UCSF.
Yeah, Bill Joy's law, right? No matter who you are, the best
people
work for somebody else.
Exactly. So I think the more that we can actually feel like we're an approachable presence and people would want to work with us, I think that actually benefits us. But then I also think that the industry just gets a bad rap, the pharmaceutical industry, which is too bad, because I think most people would accept the premise that pharmaceuticals are important and therapies are important to improve the price.
Here in California, we are particularly fond of that thought.
Yeah. These are our licensed pharmaceuticals.
Oh, I get you.
but that they're important for people's health, yet, they don't just develop it in a vacuum. So, I mean, I feel very strongly that it's such an important area, and I think the more that we can actually just break down those boundaries and just allow people to understand that the people in pharmaceutical, they're in it for a good reason. They do want to help people and help transform lives. And so the more I think that people can understand that, the better off we'll all be.
Amen, brother.
Making the world a better place.
Amen. Yeah. I completely agree with this. So I'm resonating with this. So in terms of your, again, are there any sort of specific examples you recall of either things you've learned or even can be, from either Twitter or from, that's particularly stuck with you, or examples where you've seen something that you've written or that you've shared by Twitter impact folks in a way that you really wouldn't have been able to do otherwise to sort of help make this more concrete for us?
Well, and I think the way that I try to use my social media presence is to really help with a narrative, help communicate a narrative, and that narrative is around the importance of the pharmaceutical industry to break down these barriers that we've actually discussed, but also around a specific kind of frame of mind as to how we actually do drug discovery. That is, start with a deep understanding of human biology and also what I refer to as causal human biology, and then the path to translate all of that information into an understanding that can be appropriately perturbed with therapeutics, and ultimately how that will be tested in clinical trials. So that I try to look for examples in the literature that I can actually refer to that reinforce that narrative. I try to look for examples of tweets or things that are happening in the world. So, I mean, there are many.
Well, can you give an example? Like, what's your favorite story or comment you've written so far? What's the thing that really struck you lately?
Let's see. Struck me lately. Actually, there was probably. I mean, this is a nice example of multiple sort of sources coming together. So there was a very nice podcast. Am I allowed to mention your competitor podcast? Is that okay? So all right. Yeah.
Actually, it's all a family. I think everyone's trying to increase interest in podcasts in general. So there's
a podcast, the Human Proof of Concept, Human POC podcast.
We love that podcast.
And then there was a discussion with Greg Verdeen on the druggable genome, and he came up with numbers of about 10% for small molecules and 10% for biologics. And that really gets me thinking about, you know, one of the challenges that we face with, you know, any approach to say we'll use human biology is even if you have a great target, if it comes from human genetics or some other source of information, you know, you still have to figure out how to drug it. And it was a sequence of events to say, you know, here was an insight that at least drove home a message that I knew about, but it actually made it a bit more concrete. And then it just happened, I think, within that same fear of time that I began to see some other examples of some studies that were actually done around targets. I think there was a publication in the New England Journal around one of these targets in cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, from two different groups. We're very familiar with that one.
Exactly. And St. Catharisen in his group was one of the examples of the studies that were actually done. And then you start to think about how do you put together, you know, these great targets, you know, druggability, and you realize that there are these themes and that emerge around, you know, even if we really like to use human biology as a starting point for drug discovery, sometimes it's very inconvenient and very hard, and it's actually a slower path, not a faster path. So I tried to actually kind of crystallize some of those ideas, and then I say, maybe there's something here that I could actually write about that reinforces this narrative that we've been discussing.
You know, that's such an interesting thought, and I think, you know, the buzzword of 2016 is probably precision medicine, probably eclipsing population health from last year. And yeah. You know, and you talk about, you know, the figuring out how to drug the genome, how to you know, guess the genome's functions and ways of being altered and the like. And it seems to me that so much of the work that we're seeing published, we're seeing funded, we're seeing on Twitter and the like, is all focused on oncology. And the example you gave is of cardiovascular, which of course kills a lot more people than cancer. So it's interesting. Why do you think cancer is getting most of the attention in the precision medicine front, whereas the rest of the diseases, you know, have been left behind?
Yeah. So have I mentioned my disclaimer that I work for Merck? I should probably reinforce my disclaimer now as well. Because the things that I will say have to do, of course, with some of our Merck products. But I do think that in the case of oncology, there has been this history of targeted therapies around somatic mutations in individual targets, so the Gleevec, for example. But then very recently, there have been, you know, this really just, I mean, truly is a revolution in immuno-oncology in a way to actually not target specific mutations per se, but to be able to target and to unleash the human immune system on cancers. And normally, when mutations occur and something looks different in a human body, the immune system is there to clear it. But at some point, the cancers become, of course, too smart and begin to escape the immune system. And these checkpoint inhibitors and general approaches with immuno-oncology, I mean, they're pretty remarkable, not just with the success rate, but also the durability. So I think that for oncology, one, it's the history with targeted therapies. Two, more recently, with this revolution in immuno-oncology. And even though there are the kind of the framework is a bit different from targeted therapy and specific somatic mutations. You know, the approach is actually very, very similar. I mean, you can look for mutational burden, for example, as a marker, and there have been some nice publications on this. But there are other signatures that are out there, including very simple, old-fashioned, you know, is this particular ligand expressed on the surface of cells? And you can use immunohistochemistry to actually look at that. So I think there are a number of tools that are converging with various next-generation sequencing technologies and understanding of tumors and understanding of the human immune system. So it's the history, but also some of these recent advances in immuno-oncology in particular.
So immuno-oncology might almost be a very helpful prismatic example with through which to look at the transition that you did, where after being a successful up-and-coming investigator at the prestigious Broad Institute in Cambridge, you went from there to join Merck. When you think about an area, for example, that's very well known from the reviews I read, immuno-oncology at the Broad, to joining a place like Merck, how is something, whether it's immuno-oncology or therapeutics in general, how has your framework changed, if at all, from how you see the world of immuno-oncology as a young investigator at the in academia to how you look at it from the perspective of an industry executive?
Is it like going to the dark side?
Coming to the light, I'd say. You don't know anything about academia.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe just as a brief
Please.
Background and a segue into that question, because I actually knew almost nothing about immuno-oncology before I joined Merck. And so to say and to act like, it was really this revolution in immuno-oncology which brought me to industry would be completely false. I actually learned a lot about it. In fact, everything that I know, as little as I know about it, everything I do know about it, it has been since joining Merck. But my background in terms of, as you said, I was at the Broad Institute, so I was an associate a member there. But my primary academic appointment was at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and I had an academic lab focusing on genetics and genomics of autoimmunity. We were working with a great group mining electronic medical records and working with a group of investigators from across the United States as part of this pharmacogenomics research network or PGRN. So that's what I was doing before joining Merck, and I also had a small clinical adult rheumatology practice. So I was actually thinking about the application of genetics and genomics primarily in the context of autoimmunity, rheumatologic diseases. But it was always for me about how you can actually use these tools to understand the human system and then apply them to patient care to somehow, you know, make patients' lives better. So that has always been my focus from medical school through my internal medicine residency training until my academic appointment. And as I got to understand, you know, what I call the genetic architecture of complex traits, learning that it's far more polygenic than we actually appreciated at the beginning of the kind of the GWAS, the genome-wide association study era in the mid-2000s, we certainly realized it was very, very polygenic. And I began to think that the best application of that was going to be in the context of understanding human biology and therapeutics, probably less so for diagnostics and some of the things that people would refer to as personalized medicine. And so that was my frame of reference when the opportunity at Merck that became available. And I saw, again, this kind of confluence of events to say genetic can offer these wonderful tools to understand human biology, to be applied to therapeutics. But on the other side, you know, the industry was facing and continues to face, you know, real problems of cost and delivery novel therapies. And I really thought that here was an opportunity to bring those two together, a potential solution, one of many solutions, to make drug discovery more effective and to apply it in a setting, the pharmaceutical industry, that really needed it. And then once I joined Merck, I started to learn far more about immuno-oncology, and many of the same principles applied. In fact, in some ways, what I thought about with autoimmunity can actually apply very much in the same context with immuno-oncology. I mean, neoantigens, the immune response to those neoantigens, and how to intervene in that kind of milieu.
But it sounds like you sort of entered pharma with this particular framework that you could use the sort of study of genetics to inform particularly target ID, is my understanding. Like you're saying, less so much in a sense of the biomarker and more for sort of target ID and drug discovery.
Exactly.
How has that panned out?
So I think it's panned out well. I mean, I think, you know, probably the first thing is that, you know, I've loved getting to understand the complexity of drug discovery. And I guess the message to people who are in academics is it's far more interesting than people probably appreciate who've never thought about it deeply, because it's not something that's talked about nearly as much. So you're right. I came into Merck with the idea of, you know, the fundamental problem, in my opinion, that the industry faces, you know, one, the cost of developing a new drug is far too expensive. It's far too expensive because too many things fail in phase two and phase three, the most expensive phase of the drug discovery process. They fail because of lack of efficacy, and you start to work backwards and you realize, you know, we just picked the wrong targets at the very beginning of the drug discovery process because we don't understand enough about causal human biology. And then you say there are examples like PCSK9, there are a number of others where you say, this tells you about causal events. If you perturb this target, in this case with a genetic event, not a therapeutic event, you can then observe what happens in a human living organism and make better predictions. So that is exactly what brought me to Merck. And since joining Merck, to understand and learn all about the complexities of drug discovery has been just absolutely wonderful. So I think to answer your question, how has it played out? I think probably one of the most enjoyable parts is it's played out that I, as an individual, have really gotten to understand and appreciate the complexities of drug discovery, and that's been a lot of fun. It has continued to reinforce to me that, you know, the fundamental problem still exists, that is, we don't know enough about the human system to pick the right targets. And what has evolved in terms of my thinking of this is genetics is a great tool, but it's only one tool. But there are other ways you can actually understand causality of the human system. You know, we could certainly talk about some of those examples. But genetics is one tool. It's a very powerful tool, but it's only one of the many tools that are available.
So, Robert, I was at the Milken Global Conference last week on a panel that was called something like, you know, science turns to Silicon Valley for cures. And I'm wondering what you think about that intersection with respect to understanding human biology, understanding how to better target. How essential is the technology advancement work that's going on at companies like Google and Amazon, DNA Nexus and others,
yep,
you know, to making your job easier at companies like Merck?
But also whether the data, I mean, it either address you potentially from the data end or from the sort of phenotyping side, the wearables and other approaches that folks are using to characterize phenotype and to turn things that are, you know, episodic measurements into things that are more continuous and denser.
Yeah. So great sets of questions. So I think that, you know, our goal is to understand this. Again, I keep referring to this causal human biology.
Yeah. Why don't you take a minute to explain what you mean by causal human biology?
Okay. Yeah. So human biology, of course, is, you know, just understanding the human system. But in the case of drug discovery, there are causal events, and then there are those that are just correlative. So, you know, for example, if you, in my clinical practice was in rheumatology, so if you take a look at a swollen, inflamed joint of someone with rheumatoid arthritis, you can actually look and see, wow, there are lots of genes that are differentially expressed in the swollen joint of one of these patients. But those aren't necessarily causal. They just may be correlated with the disease itself. But what was that causal event that led to the knee being swollen? And this is where human genetics, just by definition, because they're inherited, occurred before the event itself. So you know that in the sequence of events, it is a very early event, and therefore, at least by this definition, causal. So So that's sort of how I'm differentiating causal versus correlative. And there are other examples. So autoimmune destruction of certain neurons in the brain, for example, that's another example of a causal event. There was something that happened, autoimmunity against a particular cell type that then led to a particular disease.
And then back to Lisa's question about it in the context of causal human biology, the role of either data science or sort of phenotype technology.
Yep. Yeah. So I think that the more information that we can gather for humans, and in some cases, these longitudinal studies, you can actually observe events in which you can establish then causality. So, you know, say, for example, you're measuring something at a very dense level. You see another event happening, for example, the development at a very simple level, you know, the development of an infection that leads to pneumonia. And let's just say we didn't know that the cause of pneumonia was, in this simple example, streptococcus, and you could actually monitor, the infectious events. You suddenly say, wow, this person was healthy. Look, they had an infection. It looks like the infection was with streptococcus. Then suddenly something happened in their lungs and they developed pneumonia. Now you're establishing causality. And then you look, that event goes away, that is the streptococcus goes away, and they're cured. So I think the more types of things that we can establish with a longitudinal profile, and I think that denser phenotyping of humans and monitoring those events, I think will really help establish causality. Otherwise, we just wait for patients to come into the hospitals and the clinics when the event has already happened, and it starts to become more correlative. So I think that these tools will become very powerful to measure phenotypes more densely. But then there are also other tools like next generation sequencing and being able to federate genetic data and clinical data in the real world, which will also help us establish causality through examples like human genetics.
So at this point in time then, are pharmaceutical companies, whether it's Merck or anyone else, taking seriously the patient-generated data that comes out of wearables and others for use in this phenotypic inquiry, or is that still considered marginalized data?
I think that a lot of this data is indeed very dirty, but we also recognize that we need to figure out how to interpret this because this is the wave of the future. I mean, there aren't going to be too many, if any, more traditional, kind of Framingham-like cohort studies. They're just too expensive, and we can now actually repurpose data from the real world to actually establish these very large cohorts. I think this is, to their credit, what the Precision Medicine Initiative is trying to do, or one component of that. It's what's available through electronic medical records. It's what's available through, potentially citizen scientists. The more citizen scientists can get engaged in this process, I think the better off all of us will be. So I think there's a recognition that it's dirty data, but we also recognize that there aren't too many other alternatives, and we need to figure out how to actually interpret it.
Dirty data, but it's done dirt cheap.
Yeah.
I was going to say, can you be a citizen scientist if you sucked at science in high school?
You can.
You can, huh?
So are there examples, sort of green shoots you've seen of the citizen scientist or these efforts to bring phenotypic data impact drug development, or at least begin to see how it might?
Let's see. I don't know if I can.
Or what sort of things are you thinking about? And definitely nothing proprietary. I just meant in the literature or things that you're seeing out there that makes you hopeful that some of the, because the negative argument is, all this Fitbit stuff that people are doing, at the end of the day, what's it? The guy, Chris Anderson was like, he finally gave up, right, on his Fitbit. He's more or less like, it's sort of a little bit like John Belushi, like 8 years of college down the drain,
Yeah.
It's sort of like, and that's sort of how he felt about his Fitbit data. Like, so there's a certain amount of cynicism you may have noticed around about that. But I just didn't know if there are certain examples where it seems...
I think that there, I'll probably just speak in generalities in part because I don't have any specific examples from within Merck, but looking at other companies, for example, I think what 23andMe is trying to do with patient reported outcomes and linking with that with genetic data, I think that's actually quite valuable. There are relationships with companies like Verily, and I forget, I think it might be Santa Jeffy, around continuous glucose censoring through contact lenses. And you know, if you want to follow hypoglycemic events, for example, in diabetics, you know, these will be very powerful tools. So thinking about early clinical trials and getting a read on some of these outcomes. And I believe that Biogen is doing something with a company, and I forget, it might be Verily or somebody else, where they're looking at neurodegenerative disorders and movement disorders and being able to use that as a clinical outcome. So I think probably in using some of these devices in early clinical trials to get a readout, and they won't be registrational endpoints, but it'll help us understand quickly if these therapeutic interventions are working. So I think those are some actually very exciting examples, and we'll probably see that play out earlier than we will in the scenario that I described in the beginning, which is, you know, integrating genetic data, for example, with some of this clinical data to give insights into new targets. That'll take a while.
As long as you don't have to refit the mice and the flies with Fitbits, you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah.
Although this whole thing of giving wearables to animals seems to be
it's a
potentially
big trend,
the most promising application.
Fitbark.
Yeah.
Well, Robert, we're kind of closing in on the time here, but we really are so grateful that you were able to join us, that you were able to give us at least a glimmer of your world. And thank you so much for your time today. And please continue tweeting, writing, thinking, and sharing.
I will.
Really appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Take care.
Okay. Have a great day.
Robert Plenge is the vice president at MRL and head of translational medicine. He spoke with us from Boston. You can find his blog at plengen.com, and he's on Twitter at rplenge. I thought that was a really interesting show.
I did too. You know, I mean, what it really makes me think about is how little we really know about biology, if we're really honest with ourselves, and how 50 years from now, we're going to look back at the kinds of things we do now in medicine and think, oh my God, that's just yesterday's leeches.
I know, it absolutely is a question of sort of like racing to the beginning of the road. And that's actually been my consistent experience in every aspect when I was in lab, when I was in med school, every aspect of it. The idea is like, oh, medicine is applied research. But the extent to which we have such limited understanding of the human body, of the complexities and the subtleties, I mean, it really sort of almost brings to mind the audacity or the arrogance of thinking that we can sort of control it. But on the other hand, there's the obligation to still continue to
Makes
try.
Makes me glad I didn't bother going to med school, because nothing I would have learned would have been relevant in a few years anyway.
Bah.
So we're looking forward to our show next time. We'll have Jim Joyce, an entrepreneur from Dublin, Ireland, who runs a company called Health Beacon.
Oh, that'll be great.
And you can follow David's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
We're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data.
Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonic Studio A in Hillsboro, California. Take care.
Dirty data done dirt cheap. That's our motto.